So I'm very interested when we say the word disco, what both of your responses are to the word and what, you know, how you view it, what you think it is.
I don't think disco is a musical genre, as many people do. I think it was more of a cultural movement, and I think it kind of arose out of all the nasty things that were happening in the early 70s. You had urban decay. I mean, New York City was in ruins. Really bad economic recession, I suppose. And also, I guess you have Vietnam, Nixon, all these horrible things. And I think people just wanted to kind of let it all go and have a good time. I think it was almost a bit of a hedonistic kind of movement.
Yes.
And I think, you know, it has Don McLean, American Pie. You just want to play my music and forget their troubles for a while. And that's just kind of what disco, I think, was, because it wasn't just a kick drum and a hi-hat. Anyone could put that on the record and make it disco, but there were so many different kinds of songs. You had songs that melded dance music with rock, like Barabbas, or Rolling Stones did it. And then you had it with jazz funk, like Dexter Wenzel, or taking string arrangements, like with MFSB and Vince Montana. So it's quite a big scope of music out there. It wasn't just one singular sound.
Yes, and I think as well there was the whole thing, obviously, with the whole gay rights issue in New York that was going on in the early 70s. And also I think there was the loss of, in regarding sort of where it came from, black people and, you know, the Latin population as well. The whole civil rights issue was kind of buried, you know, with obviously the death of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and people like that. And I think there was this whole thing where they were looking for that escapism. Yes. To a certain way, yeah.
But it's also taken it back in a way to what I've now realised is very much his avant-garde roots and very much coming out of the 60s. There's almost a sense where it kind of, a San Francisco energy, if you like, got transferred after Altamont, you know, to New York and got mingled up with a very specific New York thing. But back then, you know, going right back to even 1970, there was this sense that it was connected just as much to feeling, you know, acid sort of sense, sort of hallucinatory sense. I mean, freedom of expression.
Yeah.
Much more than what it very quickly became, which I think is a lot of people's response to it as a sort of commercialised thing. You know, very early on, it seemed much more about, you know, the way that minorities had found a way to express their fun.
Absolutely. And also, I think it was a coming together of all different races as
sexualities,
as opposed to just one side of things. But yeah, it's definitely experimental. I mean, you look at people like Bill Laswell with Material and Nona Hendrix with Bustin' Out, and he was a very experimental musician, and that was a very disco song, Bustin' Out. Z Records, New Wave, again, they embraced disco. You had Was Not Was and Christina.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of avant-garde, and also, as you mentioned, the whole psychedelic roots. There was quite a bit of that as well. The whole cosmic disco thing is very, very psychedelic.
And also you had, like, you know, obviously you had Arthur Russell, which, you know, is everyone pretty much who's into disco knows that man. Do you know what I mean? But he was an out-and-out avant-garde musician, really.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Who used disco as his
platform.
So you're both using the words disco now. You're using it with Z, and you're using it with Arthur Russell. So you're using disco now as a genre.
So what
do you mean then when you say disco? He was disco, this was disco, that was disco. Because we're talking in some senses about something quite experimental.
Yeah.
But we're using the word disco.
Well, disco is music made, well, not necessarily made for, but definitely played in the discotheques at the time.
Okay.
So, for instance, you could have a song like Arthur Russell, Loose Joints, Is It All Over My Face? And that song was about actually getting together and seeing your friends and like Dinosaur Go Bang, seeing all your friends at once on the dance floor. It's not really the sound as much. It's just the fact that it's danceable. So I suppose it is the sound to some degree. But it's more about, it was played in the disco, but you could also listen to it at home as well. So it's not just, you know, only one-sided kind of music. In some cases that actually was.
Is it also possibly even more than music then, a case of themes? What is actually being sung about?
I think, you know, it's really funny actually, because I was talking about this to someone the other day, is that I think there's, because of people's, the way they view disco as almost like quite fluffy and they don't look at the way it is lyrically. Check a lot of disco records lyrically, You know, and it's there's some quite strong themes there. You know, there's racism there, but for the grace of God, is one of the tunes.
My machine,
you know, talking about racism. And, you know, she, as we mentioned earlier about Arthur Russell, he got quite deep lyrically. So there was some quite heavy stuff going on, within the disco framework.
Yeah, like Gene Karen, Was That All It Was?
Was That All It Was?
A crying song, if there is any crying song, breakup song. Sort of the themes of love. There was also the whole space theme, like in the late 70s with Star Wars. Well, Mika covered the whole Star Wars theme, but then there's just a lot of like Life on Mars, Dexter Wenzel. There was people kind of exploring that side of the consciousness, the zeitgeist, I guess is the word I'm looking for, of what was happening in the late 70s. So I think thematically, it kind of embraces a lot of different themes. I don't think it's just down to one. Some are just, hey, let's have a good time, throw your hands up in the air, let's see all your friends, and whatever, but or about music or about the dance floor. But there were other things that just were about politics, social awareness.
That's right.
Or sexuality. What's the woman I'm thinking of who did the song about she was with a guy and he turns out to be gay? Oh. I mean, there's a lot of things like that. There's a lot. They're going to come to me later. Great song. You know, I don't think thematically it was just one straight line.
No, I know. I was thinking very much also about the way that disco got popularized and turned into the kitscher view, if you like.
Yeah.
But even then, there was still a sense that there were consistent themes, if you like, about yearning and striving. You know, I always think the strings and the horns that became very much part of the cliche sort of immediately represent that idea of wanting to break free of environment.
There's a real
break free of a bad love affair.
Yeah.
So all that sense of breaking out seemed to be very early on.
I think a lot of that as well is there, you know, as we said, there's a real strong gay element in disco, you know, so I think a lot of that definitely came through lyrically, you know, definitely it's about that, you know, breaking free and independence you know, I will survive.
And is that also why the other thing that I find interesting about disco is the consistency of attacks on it? That there seems to be a worry from the mainstream that because it involves the minorities having fun, expressing themselves so sort of explicitly, that is its subversive element. And so their way of dealing with it is to turn it into novelty, if you like, just turn it into the glitter.
Yeah, I think there was definitely, you know, just from, you can look at the books and that, you know, there was racism involved in that, especially when they, you know, with that guy Steve...
The Disco Sucks
campaign and burning all the records. Is it Kaminsky
Chicago,
Park or whatever? Yeah, whatever it is. Burning all the records and everything else. And, you know, it was a real meathead element there.
Absolutely. You know. I think there's a lot of racism and homophobia
that
fueled a lot of that. I mean, I grew up in the 70s in the States, and there's definitely that feeling at the time, especially in the suburbs. Maybe not in the cities as much, but it's definitely disco is kind of an urban thing. Then it seeped out to the suburbs with Saturday Night Fever and got kids like me into it. You know, oh no, what's going to happen now? Going back to your other earlier question too, I think the big kind of arrangements in disco are also similar to what was happening in rock music at the time with progressive rock, not with punk rock, but certainly with bands like Yes. So there's kind of that whole, you know, movement of big sounds, big arrangements, and sometimes quite complicated as well.
Yeah, and conceptual. There was
very conceptual.
A lot of that going on.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you think that was then? Do you think that was just because it was producer-led and therefore they were sort of experimenting in the studio?
I think part of it was producer-led. Part of it was the advent of FM radio, where it was album-oriented rock. So you had the rock albums where they were albums as opposed to singles. And I think some of the kind of higher thinking disco producers, people like Gamble and Huff, they were really just producers. I can't even say they were just disco. But I think they didn't think of themselves as just one hit wonders. They really were producing, you know, an album, or they were producing an artist or producing a concept. So it wasn't just about getting flash in the pan single.
And it also seemed to be in the 70s that it was the disco producers that opened up the recording possibilities, you know, extending music, using it to mix it, to take tracks.
The edit.
The edit, absolutely.
The remix.
Primitive early electronic sort of applications, if you like, that seem to come from that world that have been incredibly influential.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look at people like Harry Suman, who really kind of, he made a great, one of my favorite disco songs ever, Underwater, which Ashley has kindly brought in for me. And... you know, he became a kind of a keyboard, what's the word I'm looking for?
virtuoso.
Virtuoso, yeah. And explorer as well. And it wasn't just to, you know, and he had his own studio. He was working on early prototypes of different synthesizers. So he kind of came from that place. He was German as well, mm-hmm. speaking of the Germans.
And how do you feel you belong to the tradition now? Where did you join in, and what did you decide that would be your role in what, by the time you joined it?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I was lucky enough to be on the cusp, if you like, of the whole disco soul boy thing in this country. You know, and as I mentioned to you earlier, you know, growing up in a small town, Harrow, you know, and it's like the first thing you want to do is escape. And that was my escape, you know, going off to places like Crackers and, you know, clubs like that, and travelling up north as well. Mm-hmm.
What were you looking for?
Just
community, or just more?
I think a bit
sound.
Of both. A bit of both, really. You know, you're looking for those records. I mean, I was lucky that where I lived, there was a shop called the Rainers Lane Record and Disco Centre, which was a very famous shop, you know. And they used to, one of the first shops really to get in the kind of disco stuff that I like, which is quite black, you know. And just go, you know, to hear these records, you had to go out, because there was nothing on the radio playing those records. That was how that all started for me. So you'd go out and hear these amazing records, and then in turn you'd hear it, and then you think, right, I'll go and get that now, you know.
Is that still the case today, really, that the reason why there's such a thriving club culture is because it's kind of hard to see on the telly or hear on the radio?
Yeah, even now, you know, I mean, there is, as far as I'm concerned, there's total room for a modern disco show to be presented on the radio, but it isn't. You know, you get little bits played, but there's massive room for that, I think.
That's kind of what I did. I was kind of involved in the second coming of disco in New York, basically.
When was that?
Okay, so I was in New York late 80s, early 90s, and I started going, I was more of a rock DJ at the time on the radio, and I discovered The Loft, and David Mancuso had reopened on Avenue B, and I started going. And I heard all this disco I hadn't heard before. My experience with disco was coming from the rock side, only really knowing Saturday Night Fever and not really knowing too much more than that. And I just fell in love with it and started a radio show called Soul School in 1991. And it was all retro stuff. It was all like garage and loft classics, and that we got a huge following in New York, as you can imagine, where people lived it the first time around. And so it got a huge following, and then things started to really happen, like Hot 97 and WBLS started doing disco shows, a bit more commercial than mine. And people started buying, I was buying up all these Larry Levan mixes and charity shops for a dollar. 5-6 years later, they're selling for $20-$30.
Yeah,
I mean,
crazy.
It was a whole big, but that was like the second coming. I think we're on the third coming of disco now, actually, with like the younger generation with clubs like Disco Bloodbath and things
like that.
And it's funny because Horse the records disco, we take for granted that we know so well, they're hearing it for the first time, which I think is incredible. Really.
And not out of date. It doesn't go out of date. No,
it's weird.
Is it nostalgic for something? Is it nostalgic for the time when it was like that? Or can it still have a contemporary appeal?
I think there's a bit of nostalgia, but I think there's a lot of contemporary appeal, because if you look at house music and techno, it's pretty pared down in general and made by producers who sometimes don't have any musical, oftentimes don't have any a musical background. And we had a whole kind of movement with techno and minimalism. Now we're into maximalism again. I think what's happened is that people are kind of reacting to all of that, saying, we want to hear real music again, music made by musicians. And these songs, I mean, these classic songs, they don't go away. I mean, you can listen to a classic song from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. They don't go away. Right. They always sound good.
So you've brought in a couple of selections of your favourite tracks, which I guess is the best way of you explaining what your passion and enthusiasm for this music is. Are they from across time, or are they recent? I love the way that you've put an exclamation mark after that.
And they're all in caps. Disco! Exclamation mark.
I think that's key. But I haven't.
I haven't. I would do that as well.
The records I've brought along, these are just really memorable records from when I first started going out.
Right. Okay.
You know, and they were just the records I thought, they just blew me away, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
I kind of tried to do a cross-section of anything I had available on CD. Most of my disco's on vinyl. But yeah, kind of a cross section from the European sound to the Baroque sound to the kind of space exploration themes to more of the avant-garde sound on Z Records and Larry Levan.
Tell me what you brought.
Okay, we have Love Is a Message, which was by MFSB on Philly International, Gamble and Huff. Yeah, it was one of the first songs to be nominated and to get a place in the Dance Music Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's called. And Danny Krivet did the re-edit. It was an illegal re-edit, but he did it. And that's kind of the one that everyone seems to know, so that's why I brought that one in.
What did he do? What did he do then?
He re-edited the...
How did he do it?
He took the Vamp, which was the second half of it, I think, wasn't it? Right. And he just...
Expanded that. That was more the disco-friendly side, whereas someone like David Mancuso plays a full thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even kids today come up like, what is that?
That's
because they haven't heard the first half. You know, because everyone knows the re-edit. Yeah. That's the one that became really popular.
Yeah.
Another one I brought in is Class Action Weekend, which is a Larry Levan mix. Larry Levan, as you know, was the DJ from Paradise Garage. And I think what he did is brought dub music really into disco. I mean, there's really lots of reverb, lots of space, and just enhancing the different sounds, using few sounds and enhancing them. Another one I brought in is Chili, which was a German band. I thought that would kind of represent Frank Farian. He was a Boney M producer, right?
That's right, yeah.
He produced this one. It's a cover of For Your Love, which was written by, was it Graham Goldman from 10cc?
Yeah.
And then performed by the Yardbirds.
So
that's kind of the crossover to show that disco wasn't just a kick drum and a hi-hat.
Yeah.
Quite psychedelic. It's another Danny Krivet re-edit. He just gave it to me in New York, so it's an exclusive for you.
Mm-hmm.
There's Bustin' Out, Material and Nona Hendrix on Z Records. That's Bill Laswell's band. And he's a very experimental musician. But this one is a pretty straightforward disco song. And it kind of, Z was also kind of on the cusp of the whole new wave movement as well.
James White.
A few others. We have Harry Thuman, Underwater, which is my favorite disco song. Well, one of my favorite disco songs ever. I could play it every single gig that I do and never.
Sounds very modern.
Never get sick of it.
Yeah.
In fact, the latest record that I just did with Wild Rumpus is very heavily influenced by that one.
We'll be right back.
Are these tracks selected because you are who you are now, if you like, as a professional, as a DJ, knowing what they do to people, knowing, you know, how important they are in that sense, or are they stuff that you are infused in your life? I mean, are they part of your life?
They're part of my life, and part of what I play as well, which, because I think what I play is part of my life. Yeah. I look at it all in the same way. I don't divorce it. Yeah, and I also try to pick a cross-section of different sounds. So you have the sound of Philly, the sound of Philadelphia, and you have the sound of Munich, and you have the sound of New York. So it was a worldwide movement, you know. It wasn't just in the States. Yeah. And I just thought it would be nice to bring in a nice cross-section.
Because there's another world that I think is rooted in the original hostility towards disco, where the rise of the DJ, you know, and the idea of just playing records that you liked, it seemed to be an extraordinary sort of thing that happened in the late 80s into the 90s, that you would just play records and you get paid an awful lot of money, become jet setters, become kind of stars in your own right.
Yeah. Exactly, because it wasn't like a karaoke DJ. You weren't paid like a wedding DJ just to play the hits. Right. You were paid to turn people onto music and how to program it.
Okay.
And I think Larry Levan was really the first one to properly do that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
he was the worst. I think he was the first one, really, where people kind of, bestowed the godlike sort of thing on him. Do you know what I mean?
So, what kind of creative act was it then? What you say turning on people to music?
Yeah, I think it's that thing, you know, the manipulation of sound, you know, and just kind of the whole idea of using the decks as your instrument. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And overlaying percussion breaks and sound effects, and which is, I think, Francis Grosso, wasn't it?
Francis Grosso did that a bit, and then you had African Bambaataa did it, and Cool DJ Herc on the hip hop scene. Larry did it with disco.
Walter Gibbons,
and so doing your own re-edits on reels, bringing that in. Greg Wilson still does it today, which is fantastic. And then also, I mean, I think partly it's musical knowledge. These are music fans. They were already playing records, just like you and I. No one said, you can have a career as a DJ. We were collecting records when we were really young and making mixtapes and giving it to our friends. I had a radio show when I was 14. You were a soul boy. You know, we were just obsessed and still are, sadly.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think you have these huge fans. They have a lot of knowledge. And a good DJ, part of it's manipulation, but part of it is just programming. Someone like David doesn't manipulate the music at all. And it's all about the sequence. And how, what song follows another, telling a story. Yeah. Larry Levan really got that from David Mancuso. And then he took it in another way, manipulating the sound and the EQs and taking out the bass and accentuating the highs.
It's a very reggae thing to do.
Yeah.
Very reggae thing to do. And people are still doing that today. Mm. And
you would be consciously telling stories then. You feel that you've got a narrative that is important.
Absolutely. You can't play a love song into a breakup song.
No, exactly. Exactly. I was just about to say that.
You have to break it up with an instrumental and go somewhere else.
I learned that from listening to, you know.
And girls listen to lyrics.
Yeah.
Girls listen to lyrics. So if you've got girls on the floor.
You know, and if you're going to play positive, you know, playing, say, four or five positive records that feed off each other. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you're having an influence out there. Yeah.
And going back to David Mancuso, it's almost that when he first started, you know, way back in the early 70s, it was that idea of the heightened environment as well.
Yeah.
And I
guess
that thing that was important to him because of the children's parties and the whole idea of play and balloons that seemed to sort of also become part of the tradition in a way.
Yeah,
absolutely. He started in 1970, 40 years ago. They're having their 40th anniversary in February. And he opened it as a rent party, you know, it's just to raise rent money. Lots of people in New York did it at the time. His just happened to last. And he also opened it up to everyone. He was big in the civil rights movement. And so there was black people, white people, Latino people. There was no homophobia. So it was open to all different sexual persuasions. And also he used to do mixtapes for the Timothy Leary parties. He knew Timothy Leary. So they had that whole kind of psychedelic awareness, spiritual awareness thing going on as well. So he did create a whole environment that was pretty unique at the time.
It still is, I think.
It still is, actually, when you go.
But has everything come from that in a way? You know,
I think the
idea of that, not the kitschy side or the mainstream side, but what it's actually always continually looking for is to recreate that kind of experience.
Yeah,
a childlike experience, isn't it?
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Abandoning yourself, letting go of your ego,
letting
go of your troubles, not thinking about work and all the problems that you have on the dance floor. Just abandon yourself and live in the moment. That's how a child lives. children don't worry too much. I'm telling my daughter doesn't. So, you know, and...
But do you worry sometimes that that's a kind of escape that ultimately leads to... Well, what it kind of led to in a way, you know, another part of the disco history, obviously, is what happened in the early 80s and the weird kind of grotesque cosmic punishment almost for just having that kind of good time. I mean, is there a sense where the escape just ultimately leads to decadence, or is it can it still be maintained within a properly psychedelic experience?
I think it's done, it did both. It resulted in decadence with Studio 54. And it kind of retained the purity of the loft. Mm-hmm. That's my view. So you have the uptown, downtown scenes, and they were very different from one another. I don't even think they visited each other that much. So I really see that's where it was split. Mm. Of course, I mean, the whole AIDS thing that happened in the 80s did make a lot of people look at how they were leading their lives and taking certain precautions, I suppose. But I have to say, I was just in New York last week, and New York is fantastic again. I went to a lot of great parties that were just kind of all different vibes, and the gay scene was really happening. Mm-hmm. Just kind of like horse meat disco here is probably the best gay party we've had in London for a long time.
I've not even been, which is a shame.
Oh my gosh, it's fantastic! It's fantastic.
Take me,
and
they're
doing a great job.
But you were talking about it as if you knew.
They're all great DJs.
Yeah.
They all know their music. They all know their music. Yeah.
Now, the media cliche of what you've just been talking about is that this is happening because there is an equivalent sort of, you know, cultural environment, the recession, etc., and people are looking for this kind of thing again. Is there truth in that? Do you think?
Absolutely,
I think
there is truth. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think it's really weird. Anytime we get a recession. Or anytime we see hard times, we always get good music. It's a way of fighting back.
Tell me about these
are records that are what highlights in my growing up as a soul boy. So the first one, like Brainstorm, Loving Is Really My Game. Fantastic disco group and made a couple of killer albums. But the first, it was a radio thing at first with me. You know, people like Robbie Vincent, you know, these guys were getting these albums in on import, you know, buying them themselves. They didn't have the budget from the radio station. Mm-hmm. But Robbie Vincent on Radio London, remember him playing tracks. And that was the thing. I'm going to be playing four new tracks off the brand new Brainstorm album. And I remember me and my friends just glued to the radio, waiting to hear these records, do you know what I mean? And first time I heard Loving Is Really My Game, I was absolutely blown away. I still am every time I hear it. I'm like, oh my God. And it's about 140 miles per hour. You know, and then after that, there's Crown Heights Affair, Dancing, which is self-explanatory, really. Sonically, what an amazing record. It was like, it's built around a hi-hat.
Weren't they the Saturday Night Fever band as well?
They might have been. But Crown Heights Affair, amazing, you know.
I really love a lot of these records because they're often commenting on themselves. They're telling you about themselves as they go along.
Self-referential.
And what you're meant to be doing.
A band like Crown Heights Affair pretty much came out of the Crown Heights district in New York, you know. Mm. And they were just like, our version of pub bands, really,
yes,
you know. Yeah. And they came out and they're playing bars and playing ballrooms and, you know, and all of a sudden they've got a record contract. And then next one, Mass Production, which I always found quite funny because There was originally a band called Brass Construction, very big, with a tune called Moving, which I think Cosmo's got and heard. And then all of a sudden, you know, this band came out, Mass Production, which is obviously a take on Brass Construction. But then they made some amazing albums themselves. And Cosmic Lust, the first time I heard that, it's a jazz record, really, with a beat, you know. I mean, the first time I heard that was just, it still does, it just blows you away. Fantastic. The next one, David Shire, Manhattan Skyline, which came off the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever. In itself, an amazing record. And talking about that whole thing about what you can actually do, what these guys did, you know, and this is like an orchestral classical disco record, but a brilliant one at that, you know. And I remember hearing that for the first time and thinking, oh my god, I wish I could make records like that. You know. And last of all, CJ and Company. They were like a vocal trio, very soulful, that made disco records, you know. So they had that whole R&B vocal thing. And then Burning Drums of Fire, I think, which Dennis Coffey produced, who was the great Detroit guitar player. And he produced some great... Yeah, and
Funk Brothers.
Yeah, the Funk Brothers, yeah. And then he started producing stuff for Westbound Records, which I think started off as a Detroit label, you know. And he was just updating that Motown thing, but just hard-hitting records. They're hard records. Mm-hmm. Burning Drums of Fire, it's just got that thing, you know. And I love that. I love those sort of records.
It is fascinating to hear you talk with such detail, because it does verge on the nerdy as well, doesn't it?
the
beard, I'll stroke in the beard.
I have to stop myself sometimes. And Cos probably does as well, you know, when you're talking to people about, kids especially, that want to talk to me about and disco, you know, and they'll sit there and they'll listen to you. And then you have to sort of stop yourself and say, I'm really sorry about that. I went off a bit there, didn't I?
The other day when I mentioned the word disco to you, your eyes lit up.
I know. It does it to me every time, though. It's like, oh.
Is it because not only have you found all this music, but there is the possibility that you will keep finding more?
Yeah, I'll always find those records until the day I die, I imagine.
And what is your view on the more popular version of what disco is? The fact you've been talking about Boney M and the Bee Gees, not quite Cher yet, not quite Kylie, but it seems to be that it doesn't necessarily offend you completely.
Some of the songs were horrible and some were great. Yeah. I think that's the way you look at any kind of music, whether it's rock or dance music or reggae.
Is it beginning to get the kind of cultural respect, if you like, that you'd always hoped
so.
It would do?
I think so. I wouldn't say to people like you know, who are just discovering it now as like a say... What's the best way to put it? Oh, then you should just listen to those sort of disco records for the sake of it. It's just using those records to build a platform, to build something new.
And when you say build a platform, what is it ultimately about? Is it about just having a good time, or are there other deeper levels in there?
It can be about anything. That's the thing. It can be about social progress. It can be about politics. It can be about just having a good time. It could be about having a breakup. It can be about falling in love. It could be an instrumental, and you can make it up whatever you want it to be. It could just be some kind of kitchen fun, like space funk or something. It means so many different things. That's why I think it's so hard to pinpoint and say disco is only this. I do believe it was more of a cultural movement. You know, and I think we are, you know, because of what's going on with the recession as well, it's probably even more apt today. It's more relevant today, I should say.
No, absolutely.
Sounds like I should be asking you both where you're going tonight then.
To bed.
Yeah, not much sleep.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.